You're listening to KHEN LP FM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado. Community-supported radio. We're streamed on the Internet at khen.org, and if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest, they are now available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. I am Melody, and this evening I have Sophia Smallstrom, and I've had her on in the past, and I'm going to put on another song here to kind of get some couple of things set up here, and I will also want to say that Sophia, we got you now.
Yes.
Oh, okay, that sounds
good. I don't hear the static.
Okay, great.
I'll tell you what it is, though. It's that music. That's low vibration music. I'm sorry to say that I have become the proverbial old lady, and by many people's standards, I'm not old. But this music that is just pounding and screaming lead guitar, I don't see how that elevates anybody.
Well, I may have to look at some more, but that is one group that I actually do like quite a bit of their music, and that is Poker Face, who does do some patriot music, but you know what? I will try to expand my repertoire.
It's not a criticism. This is, you know, part of my whole reorientation toward the world. I find that there is din, D-I-N, in the world that makes me crazy, and that kind of music is part of it, as is the sound of traffic or leaf blowers and so forth. So maybe it's just me.
Well, no, I don't think it is just you, but because I know there's a lot of people, and I really do like a lot of the music that you carry on your program on RBN. And let me, before we go any further, I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of KHEN staff, volunteer, or board of directors. And Sophia, I'm having you back on because we had a nice interview probably back in the first part of the year, and you had made the video, or do you call it a video, 9/11 Mysteries Demolitions?
Yes, it's termed by some a documentary. It documents something and explains it in a different light. So it's what I call an expository documentary.
Okay, and I was trying to get some levels here, trying to adjust here. So what I'd like you to do is kind of explain a little bit about your background so that those that didn't hear our first interview kind of get an idea of what you've done, and then we can kind of take it from there and what you continue to want, where you're going with your radio program and your websites.
Well, actually, Melody, I might shock you and your listeners, but I really have no background and I have no goal. I am simply doing what comes in front of me as a course of, I guess, my life unfolding. I don't mean to sound helpless or directionless, but there is so much right now to absorb, and I think you and I have had a private conversation about that, that you are never left with something, without something to wonder about, you know? And I find that I am fueled by inspiration, which is unpredictable. Often I wake up in the middle of the night or at the very early morning and something hits me, a way that I can connect some dots or a way that I can see to propel a certain line of information, discovery, inquiry, whatever. And that is what excites me. And I probably shouldn't reveal this if this show is going to be heard by them, the proverbial them, but they cannot control our creativity yet. They are trying to dismantle us on that level with their continual and pervasive assaults on every front, assaulting us biologically in many, many different ways. And that's what I have become interested in as a consequence of creating 9/11 Mysteries, which was an innocent endeavor. I simply did it on the suggestion of someone else. I made a video that was supposed to be, I guess, logical, number one, and professional, number two. Even though I wasn't an industry professional, I just took a stab at doing the best thing I could possibly attempt to do. And I set my standard very, very high, and I had to spend an awful lot of borrowed money to do that, but it worked amazingly. And that endeavor and that line of inquiry, you could say, opened me up to so much more, because 9/11 or any other portal, P-O-R-T-A-L, that we come through is just one point of entry. And you can come in through many points of entry into what I call the world of the rabbit holes. You can come in through vaccines. You can come in through fluoride. You can come in through the money, Federal Reserve. You can come in through, gosh, so many things. I won't even try to list them. But ultimately, they lead you to neighboring deceptions, and then you realize that we're living in a world that is entirely fictional, and that is quite a dawning.
You just stepped into an area that I met a lot of people, unless they have done the kind of rabbit hole work, may not connect to, unless we kind of describe it a little bit further than this, do you think?
We could. Again, I'm not an expert. I have kind of a journeyman's knowledge of many subjects in the rabbit hole. I have actually put up a page on my website for those who are curious. It's www.911weknow, that's WEKNOW.com. And there is a menu tab on the left side called The Rabbit Hole. And there are a few posts there with, I guess you could say, synopses of different subjects. I put up one recently called House of Credit Cards, because the whole credit card industry is just a nephew or cousin of the global takeover. And all these deceptions are working together. It's like, you know, I read a book when I was a little girl called The Five Chinese Brothers. Do you remember that book?
I'm not familiar with it.
Oh, it was very funny. It was very confusing even. It was very well done, and it had nothing to do with Chinese per se, but I think that all these deceptions are related. They're like a gigantic family of zillion tuplets, or however you want to put it, you know? I don't know how, I can't count that high, but they're all there to create for us a world that is not, a world that is an impression that is sold to us by conditioning. And fear. Fear is another delivery system that is indoctrinated in us. It's a result and it's a means as well. I read this morning on somebody's blog, and unfortunately I didn't have time to read all of it, but I will go back tomorrow. And it said that there are really only two inherent fears, and those are the fear of falling and the fear of, oh my gosh, I've now just spaced on the other one. Do you know what the other one is?
Could it be dying?
No. It's much more simple than that. It's falling and I don't know, being...
Being naked?
Pardon?
Being naked in public?
No. It's from infancy.
Oh, okay.
Infants don't like being hurt or something like that. I thought I could dredge it up as I was talking, and then look at me, I just spaced. But anyway, all the other fears are just pure conditioning. But the natural fears are this falling, and I would assume maybe pain.
Uh-huh.
I should slap myself for forgetting it. But the whole point of being in this society is to be shaped through the mechanism and delivery of fear. And we readily accept that. We drink fear up because it is hardwired into our reptilian brain. Fear keeps us safe to some degree, and learned fear is an experiential kind of database. You know, don't touch that stove. It was hot last time you touched it. So don't touch it again unless you check to see whether it's hot or not. But we can't live that way because that's becoming our undoing.
Since the last... Well, I'm not sure. Had you started your radio program when we did our last interview? I don't think you had you?
No. I started it in February of this year, and I think I interviewed with you and Eric.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine it was not this year, but the year before, because 9/11 Mysteries had been out, and I think it was last winter, not this past winter.
Well, actually, I've only been doing this just a little over a year for live interviews, so it would have had to been somewhere in
maybe it
January,
was the fall
something.
Of 2007.
Well, it's possible, but you know, one thing that I'd noticed—I mean, because I do listen to your program, I don't necessarily catch it live, but I will go back into the archives. Like, you know, I archive all my programs, and. In RBN, your Republic Broadcasting, which is the network that carries your program, archives yours. And I see a wide array of guests that you interview. And when you're talking about what you started with as far as how we... I guess I've lost my train of thought now.
It's all that fluoride and all those chemtrails.
Well, we did get into chemtrails a little bit on that that evening, but there's a lot of things that are going on and around our world, and it's like you were saying that we enter this portal through many different aspects or have that opportunity to go down the rabbit hole and explore areas that somehow we hadn't been awakened to prior into our lives, and now it seems like I jump from one rabbit hole to another one, and I think that maybe I've gone to the end and figured it all out, and then before I know it, I'm there's another one another tunnel to go down and explore, but in the end it seems like they all come out into one Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, they're all part of the systematic encroachment into human free will. And the goal is to take that over. Because I think, I should state as though I know what this is about, but the most amazing thing about humans is that they're not predictable. They don't even operate by instinct. I think that I'm not, a naturalist or a zoologist or an animal specialist, but I think that animals are a little more predictable because mainly they're governed by instinct and some learned behavior and experience and a limited amount of reasoning, but not a whole lot of that. Yet humans are extremely unique. We have much more individuality to us than other mammals, and we have much more intellect. We actually have an intellect. I wouldn't go so far as to say that other mammals have intellect. And we also have an emotionality that is unique and that is extremely one of those primarily expressed traits or affects. Humans are extremely emotional creatures, and they can organize themselves and their personalities by emotion rather than instinct. So I think that we are very different creatures from other members of the animal kingdom, and our uniqueness, to use an overused word, is that we are unpredictable, and we have these three sort of classifying features: intellect, individuality, and emotion. And I think something, I will say something and not someone, something is striving to make us all more uniform and very much more controlled, and to capture from us forever that thing that is our free will, to take it away such that we don't operate by free will anymore and we're completely dominated and controlled.
Then you're saying they're trying to make us predictable, if that, yes. If you, I mean, of that, are of that belief. I'm not so sure that we aren't predictable, but we have a lot of we have a lot of leeway to work within, and being the kind of mind that we have, we have a lot of potential to utilize those the mind in such a way that we can go many different paths to react in many different ways. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, but you're basically saying we're not that predictable.
Maybe. Maybe I am disagreeing a little bit on that. But I don't know. I don't know. I'm not saying it's a, you know, I'm not an expert on it. I'm often hearing how people are termed sheeple. And so, obviously, I mean, to be termed that term, that would be from predictable behavior, would it not?
But that's already scripted. That's already
okay.
The result of centuries of programming.
Okay, so then it's the programming that makes us predictable, and not the potential of us being unpredictable because of us being in our innate nature. Is that what you're saying?
Well, elementally, we are far more unpredictable than any member of the animal kingdom.
Okay, I'll take that.
So, elementally, that's what separates us, and you could even say elevates us.
Okay.
But because of centuries, I should even say millennia of programming, the whole social order that differs a little bit culturally, but on the whole, there's a social sameness in throughout the world. I mean, we group in nuclear families, and we have a hierarchic order to us. What we appoint one as a leader, and this kind of thing. That is all about programming and shaping. Something has decreed that, and is that just a natural way that we form in groups, or is that part of a slow approach into a one world order?
Okay. So where do we go with this? I mean,
well, you were talking about the different rabbit holes, and you wanted
okay.
to maybe touch
okay.
on some of the different subjects. And one thing that I am realizing is that there is an ongoing global covert operation, which is that the spraying program and the transformation of our natural world into an artificially engineered world. So as they are engineering us in our group behavior, and even down to the level of controlling individuality, to shrink that capacity in us, they are also altering and diminishing the variation and I guess you could I'll just use the word magnificence of the natural world and natural orders as they occur, natural protocols as they occur in biology and the environment, in flora and fauna. All this is being diminished at the same time, limited, deliberately.
Right, and you and as I have interviewed so many different people in so many different avenues of backgrounds to find out that a lot of us are still are coming to the same conclusion, those of us that are looking. Now, granted, there are those who choose not to look, but those of us that seem to be looking are starting to come to some conclusions that meet, and that information, I mean, the information that bring us to that point is out there all over the place, correct? Or do you find that?
Yes. I mean, the information is something that first you have to wake up to one little chapter of it. It can be anywhere, in any one of those rabbit holes. But then, if you apply this thing called social conscience, which is another thing they're trying to rub out of us, and your own curiosity and your own ethics and your own wattage even to that, then you will find more and more and more. And all of it is out there. It's just a matter of when and how you trip over it.
You know, you did an interview with David Icke, and when you came away from that interview, what do you feel that you gained from that?
Well, David Icke is a, you know, major figure who has been speaking about the political side of this, and then, of course, the consciousness aspect of it. And I learned that he is much more interested in the consciousness part even than the political part. That's his favorite place to explore. But what did I gain from the David Icke interview? I was happy to hear how committed he was to encouraging people to think outside of their own helplessness. We are taught to define ourselves in a kind of profile that is the, you could say, net result of our experience. I am Sophia. I made 9/11 Mysteries. I have a radio show. I'm 49 years old, for those who are interested, etc., etc. I'm 5'4". I have brown hair. You know, this is what I appear to be. And yet, we accept those definitions as, that's the encyclopedia of who I am, you could say. I'm encouraged by society to say, this is who I am. This is all that I am. When in fact, it isn't, because there's loads of stuff I haven't ever done. And he is, I think, on some level, asking us to cast aside limitations that we use ourselves as a form of self-definition, and open the entire realm of possibility and admit it into our lives. And that seems like a very airy-fairy, New Age, hogwash recipe. But actually, he's totally correct. We can do anything if we just would let ourselves. And yet we're not raised to allow ourselves to do very much at all. And that's the sad thing.
You know, when you speak of that, it's like at this point in time we're listening to a lot about what's going on with the bailout and the monetary situation that's going on in this country and in the world. But then when you transfer to the fact that we're talking about fiat money that is an illusion, and it's an illusion of debt that you can make it real. I mean, you can make it on transfer into people having to spend not only their lives but their children's lives, or we can make it something else. And I think, does that, I think is, we can also kind of see it as an opportunity. And I don't, and it kind of sounds kind of strange in a way, but I feel like they're the ones making up the rules. They're the ones that are putting, trying to put us into debt. And if we just walk away from, you know, it's them that did it. It is them that wants to put us in within this category. And if we realize that we can do something with this, that's a definition that they created. Does that?
Well, yes. And I think that maybe what you're trying to say, I don't know if this is correct, but for instance, I tell people, look, the bankers are the bad guys. And I'll say it again, the bad guys. You guys are the bad guys. Anyway, all right, so they print money. They print it out of thin air. It could be toilet paper for all we know, right?
Right.
It's worth less. It has no worth. It's just, that's what you mean by the illusion. Well, for them, it's limitless. If they need another 10 billion, they just print 10 billion. So why do you and I hold on to a $5 bill and say, this is the last $5 I have? Why isn't it limitless for us?
Right.
So when I made my movie, I was juggling debt on, like, I kid you not, 10 credit cards. And I memorized, like a good little girl, I'd wake up in the morning and I'd go, okay, today's Tuesday. It's the 5th of blah, blah, blah. Today I have to pay Union Bank. And on the 10th I have to pay such and such bank. And on the 12th I pay Chase. And on the 16th I pay AT&T. And it was all memorized. And I never missed. And that's, I realized that all these credit cards were just, this revolving credit was just an open universe to me. I was being awarded opportunity by them. And even if they expected me to fail, like they expect everyone to fail, that wasn't necessarily written in stone. And if I could just play by all their rules, and use what they were holding out to me and make something great with it, then I might end up on top. So their system enabled me to do something, because I didn't consider it a limited system. I didn't consider myself to be limited.
And I think maybe that's where David Icke is coming from, in a sense, is that if we live within their confines, then yes, you know, we're going to be confined. But if we look beyond the box and realize that, you know, if they can make up rules and a system, we have that potential there too. Particularly if the system that's going on around us at this point in time is in a position to discontinue.
Right, and we have to reverse the illusion, and we have the power to do that. And I've never really said this before, but listen, we make the rules. They don't have to make the rules. This time we're going to make the rules. It's our world. There are way more of us than there are them. And our rules are, okay, there's this system, everybody's using it, so I'll use it too, and I'll use it to my advantage, and to the advantage of all my kind of people. You know, it's not going to be to your advantage. You put it in place, and I'll figure out how to use it. Until we create our system, then you'll have to use our system, and our system is exposing you.
Well, it's a little bit to think about, but it, you know, we also have to, you know, do bear in mind that, you know, what's going on around us, we have to be activated and take action in this. And they're willing to back it up with efforts that, you know, it could be life or death.
But again, that's just on this physical plane.
Right.
And if you are fearful of your own death, then yes, that's like the end of the road. But that's, again, operating within a limitation.
Right.
We're never going to get anywhere if we're afraid. We just will not be able to do it.
No, that's true. I mean, there's a point in time, you know, and particularly when you interview so many people and it comes down to the point that their ultimate goal is to limit the population on this planet to the point that many of us are not going to be here, and many of them may not even be here, then we need to really start looking at that issue a lot, because the reasons that they're giving us for not having many of us here on this planet is lack of resources and that sort. But then again, they're living within a limited realm on resources that, you know, we're accepting their numbers, their figures, and that sort. And fortunately, up to this point in time, they haven't been quite truthful about much.
We don't need their truth. All
right.
We need is our creation. We don't need anything from them. And that's what we haven't understood yet. We still live in their paradigm. We can create our own world, and you do it by being an individual and by being extremely free and by understanding what your freedom really is all about. Your freedom is the freedom to feel any way you want to feel. But guess what? You have to decide how you want to feel. And most people have very, very unconsciously decided to feel afraid and unhappy and limited. Those three things. And so that's their reality.
You did an interview with Michael Kaufman. And he, I've listened to a number of his interviews. What do you feel, was there anything that you came out of that interview that you felt you hadn't been aware of before?
Well, I had watched his video, and I really interviewed him to learn, for him to expose what was in his video to my audience and to encourage people to watch it and for him to give his overview on global warming being something that is, again, one of their trumpeted cries, which really is a utility that they are making use of to enforce their global government. And Michael Kaufman, apparently in the 80s, was appointed to some government board of scientists exploring the global warming phenomenon, and he realized very early into that assignment that everything they were saying was untrue, and there was something else that was going on here. There was an agenda, and then he figured out it was the one world government. So what I got out of that interview was this: anybody can wake up anytime. We can all become... Everybody can become a Michael Kaufman. And the question is, how and when is everybody going to wake up on that level? We don't know the answer to that. But, you know, every day a difference is being created. And it's being created by us, by our contribution to the ascension of humanity.
Well, just, you know, by those of us speaking the truth is one form of stepping out away from those who lie behind non-truth. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm finding more and more people daily, even though those people may have been there long before I ever came along and become aware of what was going on in the world. And even though, you know, there's, I'm sure, many people out there that would disagree with what I have interpreted as taking place in our world, but I, at this point in time, I'm starting to see more and more people waking up to the same reality that of those that are looking. Would you say?
Well, yes, I think more and more people are waking up, and maybe because more and more people are feeling more profoundly or powerfully that something is quite wrong. You know, there's no reason for Alzheimer's to be increasing at the exponential rate that it is, and cancer, and this and that, and why is the world in such chaos? Surely we can do better. But they understand something's wrong. And then when you show them that here's this one thing, look at this one thing, here's how it is wrong, and here's why it is wrong, and here is the fact that it was deliberately made wrong. And if they can catch on to that one thing, then boom, it's a hall of mirrors, or it's a bunch of falling dominoes. I don't know what other kind of analogy to use, but that's the opening. And each person who wakes up once can wake up 1,000 times and can become, it's really about becoming free. You know, I don't get depressed by this. I get inspired. I find it all very exciting. It all makes tremendous sense. It's all very exhilarating to know. And I think all of that is, I've arrived there somehow. I think I actually skipped the anger and the depression. I never, ever experienced anger and depression on any ongoing basis. Momentarily, yes. I'd experience an outrage or a real disappointment or a frustration, but I have never been buried in my own despair about all this for very long. And I'm talking a matter of a couple of hours max. It doesn't usually go on any longer than that. I then think of, all right, now what can I do? So, yes, to answer your question, people are waking up, but I would like those people to understand how much ability they possess innately to do something. And it comes from their spirit.
I interviewed Bob Chapman this morning, and I will be airing this in the future, but he's been in the arena of, I guess, one of the top gold and silver dealer brokers in the world, and has been out there trying to awaken people to the truth for, I think he said, almost 50 years. And I found that, you know, quite amazing to find somebody that has, I mean, this is a man that's 72 years old, and he's still out there doing 20 radio shows a week and putting out a publication, one of the best in the world for financial, the International Forecaster, I believe, and trying to inform people on what's going on in all the markets. And it's phenomenal to watch how somebody that is awake and attuned to what is going on and willing to speak the truth. And I see people like that, like you, who are willing to step forward and say, you know, there's something that needs to be done here, and I think we can all do that, and feel, you know, although he didn't have necessarily a good outcome of what's going on with our country right at this point, unless, you know, we realize, you know, it's going to come to something more than we'd like it to. Where do you go? How do you deal with that aspect of those who think it's the revolution is going to be more than just spoken of?
You mean it's going to happen and mm-hmm. it's going to be ugly and people are going to have to hide food and make bunkers and buy guns? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, yeah, there are those that they're definitely speaking along those lines.
Well, I can't tell you whether that's going to happen or not, but I can tell you this. We're not going to win any revolution because of guns or hoarding food or hunkering down in some hidey hole and waiting it out and fortifying ourselves with supplies. That's not how we're going to do it. So whether you create those supplies for yourself or not is entirely a psychological issue.
You know, and in a sense, I'm sure there's going to be plenty out there that are going to disagree with, you know, where we're going with this. But in the long run, I think you make a lot of sense, because I mean, when you read their books like the Report from Iron Mountain, whatever, I mean, these guys thrive on war. I mean, is this what we want to continue to create over and over again?
Right. We cannot do anything about this on the physical level. They already have it in their millions of deep pockets. I was going to say in their pocket, but they have more than one pocket. They have all the pockets, and they have padlocks on all the pockets. So, you know, you and I could sit here and organize a march on Washington, and we could get artillery and this and that and a plan, and it's not going to do any good. That we can't do it that way. We have to do it on a whole other frequency, and that's what humanity has forgotten. I was about to say that's what humanity doesn't understand, but that's not true. We already understand that. We just have forgotten it, and they have deliberately made it so we have forgotten.
And
I'm going to give you an example, all right?
Go ahead.
Okay, so this is a dumb example. A lot of people could say this is stupid. They could dismiss it. But I don't think it's stupid. My little digital camera began to make beeping noises this summer. And it was very irritating. I couldn't get it to stop. So I said to myself, all right, it's time to check out the manual and let me see what the troubleshooting guide says. So I went, I'm an organized person, I went to the shelf in my closet where I had the original box, the Olympus box, and I opened it up and looked for the manual. And there was the French manual and the Spanish manual, but no English manual. And I said, now, what did I do with the English manual? It's not here. Did I put it somewhere? Did I lose it? That's not possible. I don't lose things. So I thought back, and I remembered that a couple of years ago I had gone down to my graphic artist's house with the manual because I was doing something with my camera, and I wanted him to show me. And I had the manual, and I thought, if I left it at his house 2 years ago, it's gone. He's not going to have it or be able to find it. So I went online and I found a PDF of the manual, and it was very irritating because the manual is a small little booklet, and here were all these small pages, 72 of them, and I couldn't turn them in my hand the way I wanted to. So I never really figured out how to fix my problem from the online manual, and I ended up calling Olympus. And of course, when the tech was on the phone, my camera behaved perfectly. I wanted him to listen to the noises. He didn't know what I was talking about, which I found bizarre. But anyway, I put him on the phone, turned on the camera, and there's no noise at all. So I said, well, I don't know what to tell you. It was doing terrible things for a month, and now it's not doing anything, and I guess that my problem is solved. I still don't have my manual. And anyway, I said goodbye to him, and I kept hunting for my manual because now that was my remaining problem. Where is this Olympus English language manual that I should have? So I went to bed that night and I said to my subconscious, that's our best friend in the world, by the way, and I said, all right, so I guess I have mislaid the manual. I want you to find out where I put that manual, and I want to know by morning. So I fell asleep, and in the middle of the night, I was awakened by my subconscious, which was effectively drumming on my skull with its knuckles and saying, I know where the manual is. Do you want to know right now? And of course, it's the middle of the night, and I said, all right, fine, tell me. But I'm not going to get up and get it right now. So my subconscious said, it fell off the shelf in the closet, and it fell into the pile of clothes on the floor of your closet that you're going to alter when you have spare time. And I said, okay. And I, again, was committed to not getting up in the middle of the night and rummaging in my closet in the dark. So I figured, I care about this enough that I'll probably remember in the morning. And sure enough, I woke up, and that was my first thought. Well, I must get in my closet and see where that manual is, if my subconscious was right. So I got up, I went into the closet, rummaged in the pile of clothes, and sure enough, there is the manual. It was hiding among those clothes, and it was in the little plastic bag I had put it in to take it down to my graphic artist's house. It was totally unscathed, no bent pages or anything. And I thought, now, isn't this amazing? Because I didn't put it in this pile of clothes. And my subconscious didn't tell me where I mislaid it. It actually went into the universe and found the manual and told me where it was.
So, okay, so what are we going to do with, you know, trying to rework this aspect of, you know, I mean, we have been, I mean, it seems like humanity on this level has been, you know, like you said, programmed and into settling our problems with war. And to me, war is a failure of being able to work something out. And yet, there are those that think that that's the most easy functioning way to solve problems or to conquer and take from others. And it's up to the rest of us to start trying to create a new way of handling and showing some intelligence, as far as I'm concerned, of not, you know, I mean, once we start building weapons, what are they going to do with them? They have to use them. So, I mean, that's one aspect of what takes place right now. And the other aspect is, it's always if somebody else sees something, they want to make it theirs. And that seems to me what we're dealing with on a very basic level at this point in time. Does that ring true to you at all?
Actually, I think that you're taking this into the group setting. What are we going to do about all this? How are we going to reorganize ourselves so we don't use war to settle our differences? Well, to start with, I don't think war is being used for any reason other than planetary genocide.
Well, that's, you know, no, and I don't have to agree with you in that.
Yeah, there is no real, war is not fought for over religion or for land or for a control or conquest. War is about war, period. In fact, I'm about to do a mass email to my customer group, who are wonderful people. My online store is avatarproducts.com, A-V-A-T-A-R, avatarproducts.com. Anyway, I watched a video about Vietnam. It's new, and a guy from L.A. made it. And one of the lines from one of the fighter pilots, and he's just basically talking off the top of his head. He says, yeah, the plane I flew was known as birth control. And the implications of that are very, very sad. That weaponry is, it has nicknames like birth control. But that's the point. He actually encapsulated the entire point of this whole history. It is about birth control. It's about limiting the gene pool and the population by sheer destruction and pain. And so, how do we solve that? The only place I would say we have to work, and I'm saying it's the only place, is within ourselves, and it's the only place we can work.
No, we can, I have to agree.
There's no need, in my opinion, to try to do this on a group level and try to strategize and reorganize and rebuild and recreate. We're never going to be able to do it as a group because it's not doable as a group. It is all about you. Who are you? How do you operate? Each of us has to start using our subconscious in the way that I just described. That was a pure experiment on my part, but it had an amazing result. It shocked me. And when we start doing that, everything else will change. When we start appropriating and recovering our own utter magic, that's when it's all going to rearrange. We're not going to have the UN or any of these groups for anything ever again. But we have to delve into our possibilities to that extent first.
You know that... Maybe I should not go into that direction at this point, but I do need to probably say that this is KHENLP FM radio, 106.9 Salida, and this is Truth Quest with Melody, and I have as a guest Sophia Smallstrom, and we're talking about numerous different aspects, but I do want to say that support for KHAN and TruthQuest is brought to you by Kevin Barnes, Agent for Land Property, Inc.'s Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at coloradohomeproperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. Sophia, when you'd made your film 9/11 Mysteries, you'd talked about part one. Do you ever plan on following that up, and do you see a need to? Or,
well, there's of course a need, but I haven't begun part two. I haven't begun to produce it. For a few reasons, I think that 9/11 is not the most important issue on the vine right now, number one. And number two, there are certain elements of my part two that the American public hasn't demonstrated readiness for. So it's a timing issue, you could say. I'm not going to reveal on the air what those elements are, but the time isn't yet right.
Well, I can understand that. And in your radio program, it's called Expansion.
Yes.
And it's on Republic Broadcasting Network.
Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, or republicbroadcasting.org for the online listeners, and there are archives, and I write little blurbs about each show, so you just go to Expansion, Sophia Smallstorm, and there you are.
Sophia, I'd run across, you had a different last name at one point.
That was actually revealed by somebody who is trying to destroy me, so I'm not going to discuss that.
Okay, all right.
I use the name Small Storm.
Okay.
And that's it.
Okay, well, I'll accept that. I run across it several times, and I just was curious, but I won't go there. How about with the 9/11? I'm kind of starting to re-examine some of the things that have taken place, and part of the reason why I'm re-examining those things is, again, it's like with the banking problem that's going on right now. It seems like the same figures keep cropping back up, and it's almost like it's like telling us if we don't address the issue and hold, you know, people accountable, they just kind of seem to want to just do it over and over and again, and everybody gets to pay for those things that we are not holding them accountable as a group. Does that make ring true to you?
You're saying that if we don't hold certain people accountable, they'll just do these things again and again?
Yes.
And what do you mean by these things?
Well, like the banking situation where we have many of the rules that used to be in place have been taken away and then abused, and now they're trying to leave us with debt that they created. I mean, by deregulating and by trying to entice the public into indebtedness that, you know, I'm not saying that the public shouldn't take responsibility for their own finances, but what I'm trying to say is that expecting us to cover their backs when they were the ones that had abuse the system in their own right.
Well, they created the system. Then mm-hmm. they got paid twice, three, and four times by us. But if we're stupid enough to do that, then it's our fault. So we're not bailing them out. We're participating in them ripping us off. And
you always have a much better way of stating things than I do.
Well, I don't know. That's not very elegant, maybe, to say it that way.
Well, but it's right on.
So the question is, you know, how much do you want to participate in this? And most people would say, I don't. So I can think of loads of ways to make it better. But if people aren't willing to do that, then
well,
I can just continue.
Well, in one respect, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, many of us didn't raise our voices and try to take action when we had a Congress that allowed the bailout. Now, how do we not participate, or how do we participate in that type of thing? That's what I'm kind of looking at, is there's certain points in action, inaction, that I'm having a hard time understanding.
Okay, well, let me give you an example. The money that is used now for this bailout is money that the American taxpayer is going to have to provide through taxes. So, my question to you is, what is income tax really about? And I've done three radio shows on it. I've put up a website, notincome.com. I am not of the Aaron Russo group that says, just don't pay your taxes and hope for the best and run from the IRS. But there is a legal way to disengage yourself from quote-unquote tax liability every year. And that is what the income tax return was designed for originally. And it has escaped the notice of almost every American alive. So if you can bring yourself to understand your lawful right with regard to the income tax issue, you disengage from it legally, and this is the only legal way to do it, and it is 100% legal, and the IRS admits that. They continue to admit it over and over. They're sorry that they're being found out. So there, number one, that's the one easy action type of thing you can do to not support this total rip-off of America. But you know what? Most people don't want to do it because it means breaking out of their wormy psyche that they have grown used to like an old smelly slipper. Talk about inelegant metaphor.
It was Mr. Hendrickson. Is that who you...
Keith Hendrickson, yeah.
Okay. That is the one program that I have missed, and I know you did two or three interviews with him, and somehow they seem to be the ones that I haven't gotten a chance to review, but I'm going to make a point of it from this point, because I have really listened to numerous programs about ways to not participate or ways to work around and that sort of thing, and some and a lot of them seem, you know, even make sense to me, and then I see some of the people that participate in them don't necessarily have an easy time of breaking loose of that. So
the taxing,
mm-hmm.
Well, do you want me to give you the taxing in a nutshell?
Go ahead.
Alright, so income tax is not a direct tax. It's an excise tax. That means it applies only to activities in which the federal government has a role or an interest. So, if you are a federal employee and they're paying you, your earnings are coming from a federal nexus, you pay income tax. There's a reason for that. It has to do with the benefits that federal employees get, the retirement, et cetera, et cetera. All of that is furnished by a portion of their income that is taxed while they are in the employ of the federal government. So, up until 1942, only 4% of Americans were taxpayers. Namely, they worked for the American federal government and they paid income tax on a yearly basis. And that was that. Then, in 1942, the one and only Milton Friedman of the U.S. Treasury made a pitch to Congress. This was in a Senate subcommittee hearing, August 21st and 22nd. And he pitched for a broad income tax to help the war effort. America was going to enter World War II and needed revenue from the public to support that. So Friedman said to the senators, hey, we would like to start this broad income tax. And there were three senators involved in this particular transcript that is on the record. And one of them, Danaher, I think his name was, he said, you mean to say you want to take tax from non-taxpayers? Because non-taxpayers comprised the majority of the population. Namely, they weren't even eligible to pay income tax because they weren't federal employees. And Milton Friedman said, yes, we do. It'll only be temporary. And they will be able to recover the money that we withhold from their wages. This was the institution of the wage withholding program. They'll be able to get that money back at the end of the year. And Senator Danaher said, and how are they going to get that back? And Friedman said they will file an income tax return. So do you understand? The Internal Revenue Service was put in place to temporarily borrow your money for a year so that that would constitute revenue for the government. And then at the end of that year, if you were not a taxpayer by definition of the income tax code, the Internal Revenue Code, then you got to ask for your money back, hence the 1040 U.S. individual income tax return. That's what it's all about.
Okay, so...
So how do they do it? How have they pulled the wool over everybody's eyes? They started, at the same time as their wage withholding program, they started this practice of filing what was called information returns. So the employers in the country, and I'll put the word employers in quotes, because in the code itself, there are five words that are specifically defined, and yet you and I interpret those words in a very common usage. And these are not common words. They're not defined commonly in the code. And those words are income, wages, employer, employee, and U.S. trade or business. And there is a very specific definition that is shared by those five words. And it all has to do with the federal involvement. So, what they did as of 1942 was they started this skunky practice of employers reporting on their employees and sending these information returns to the IRS. Now, the 1099 and the W-2 are the forms I'm talking about. They're called information returns, and they are actually government forms intended for use only by federal entities, not by the, you know, small company that makes toilet seats for the public. It's not the it's not for anybody other than those who are involved with the federal government or federal employers. So unfortunately, everyone has been tricked into using them. So millions of quote-unquote employers who aren't federal entities use these pieces of paper, and they write names on those pieces of paper of individuals who aren't making federal money. And so the moment your name is entered on a 1099 or a W-2 and a copy of that is sent to the IRS, there you have it. Now you earned federal money. Your name is on a federal form. Those entities using the forms reporting on you are actually criminalizing themselves. They don't know, and the IRS isn't in any big hurry to tell them either. You shouldn't be using those forms. They're government forms. Only government employers need to use those forms. They're happy that the names of millions of people end up on those forms in their own little hot hands. And then they wait for you, by April 15th, to answer those returns. Because those returns are testimony that has been issued about you by others. So your opportunity comes on April 15th, or before, if you're an early bird, and you get to agree with what's on those returns. And most people do. They say, yes, I did earn $30,000 from so-and-so, and here's my copy of the return, and you staple it to your 1040, and you cry for a little bit of reprieve with your expenses and deductions, and that's all they give you, the expenses and deductions. And they've created a whole industry of professionals that helps you figure that out. But really, you can also do something completely different. You can say, folks, I wasn't a federal employee, and I am rebutting these charges that have been filed against me by Joe Schmo Contractor, and I'm not liable for income tax because this wasn't income by your definition. And that's it. And then they have to give you back all of your withholdings, or you don't have to pay tax for the amounts written on those 1099s that were issued.
And has this been tried over and over?
So far, the IRS has refunded $3.5 million collectively to people who have filed this way. They've been doing it, most of them, since 2003 when Pete Hendrickson's book came out. And it takes an awful lot of courage to do this because you have to be able to write zero on gross income. Zero. And most people think income is what I put in my bank account. It's what was on my paycheck. But it isn't. Income is that which was paid to you by the federal government.
And that's not including any kind of a benefit or, say, like disability or anything like that?
Disability comes from the federal government.
Okay, so then it does benefit.
It's all taxable.
Okay.
So anything that comes from a federal nexus, you have to declare as such, and you can pay tax on that. Or you can use the deductions and whatever they give you. I mean, that's their money. So that's the money that, yes, is
taxable
by their definition. But the money that you earn through your consulting for private clients and so forth, and whatever you do, is not federal money. Unless you happen to inquire as to the source of that money and you find out that it is. But anyway, you know, this is the concept. Everybody has to do their tax return themselves because it's their personal testimony sworn to about their taxable activities.
Okay. So of all the interviews that you have done up to this point in time on your radio program, which ones do you feel like stand out the most and apply to your reason for doing radio?
Well, honestly, I did the radio show as a favor to someone. I often end up doing things as favors. People say, you have to do this, would you please do it? And I go, okay. I'm not doing the radio really because I want to do it. I'm doing it because people really like the shows, and I have no idea why. I'm, in many ways, as dumb as they come. I have a lot of guests on who surprise me. They have incredible depth of knowledge. I am learning right along with my listeners. And in many ways, each show is kind of its own thing and has its own surprises. But I have to say that as far as inspiration goes, I think the Pete Hendrickson shows are at the top of the heap. And All Is One Heart Song, the spiritualist, I guess you could call him, the former psychologist, Arthur Earl Jones, those are top shows for me because they really reflect the opposite ends of the spectrum. One is real action you can take that frees you psychologically, and that is doing your taxes the right way, the real way that Congress intended, the way that you are protected by the law. You know, that's the whole thing. The way everyone does their taxes is totally illegal. The employers are criminalizing themselves, and the people who swear that they earned federal income, that's not true in most cases, and people don't even realize that. So they're participating in the fraud by not even knowing that it's grossly fraudulent for this to be going on.
Since it's gone on this long, and if people, do you think that possibly if people caught on to it, do you think that they would re-examine it?
They can't re-examine it because, you mean like change the law? They can't because, as Pete Hendrickson said on my last show, they'd have to explain to the whole American public why they were trying to change the law and enforce taxes. And hopefully people wouldn't be, you know, dumbed down enough to not get what that was all about, because we have been, there has been extortion of our money through this income tax now for an awfully long time. And if you add up the money, it's just horrible. People are paying, some people pay $50,000 or more a year in tax. That's the income for, you know, many people in the United States. I think the average peak income in the U.S. is like $45,000. So, peak. You know, so you have to just think about it. How active do I want to be? And then you have to quit being afraid. A lot of people are afraid of the IRS. I said to Pete, all they need to do, you know, is just buy a bunch of steel gray vans with sliding doors, paint IRS in ugly letters on the side, tint the windows black, and put Rottweilers inside, barking Dobermans and Rottweilers, and drive around town. Everybody would be even more afraid.
Now there's, you did an interview with William Roberts that I thought was a step out from a lot of the interviews that I have seen on numerous programs, and you got into, was it wastewater?
Oh my gosh, that was amazing, wasn't it?
Yes.
I hope you enjoyed that one.
Now it's quite informative. There is one other person that has been dealing with water primarily, and that has been Dr. Wynn Parker, and he's also on Republic Broadcasting. But this is an avenue that really needs to be explored by people, because we're going to be fed this stuff if we don't start, and we are being fed this, if we don't start speaking up and paying attention to what is going on with not only what's, you know, we're drinking, but what how they're recycling water back into our diet. Isn't that kind of what the gist of what William was talking about?
Yes, apparently the reclamation industry is a booming business now. And they're able to rescue from the sewage, oh my gosh, puppies and pills and you name it, it's in there. But I think if I understood the article correctly that I read, which was called Wasteland, I think it was by Fred Kaufman, and it was in the February 2008 Harper's Magazine. It's an amazing piece of writing. And if I understood it correctly, they are trying to reclaim substances from water that is flushed down the toilet, and I suppose it washes down the sink and out of the bathtub and all that, and they're trying to put them back on the market. And if you do it right, and it can be done right, they have the technology now to separate not just the solids, but all kinds of elements and compounds out of wastewater. They can separate caffeine, they can get Tylenol, they can get, my gosh, all kinds of pharmaceutical drugs. And I think they're looking at ways to recycle that right into us.
I heard something, I think it might have been today or yesterday, that I'd been hearing the fact that they had been finding, you know, these drugs and medications in our water that we drink, but something to the effect that they might want to add it to our water.
Right. Well, of course, the adding is one thing, and then letting the residue remain there is another possibility also. Apparently, hospitals and individuals are famous for flushing expiring or unneeded, unwanted pharmaceutical drugs down the toilet. And so an awful lot, there's a big concentration of a lot of stuff in the wastewater, and maybe that isn't ultimately all filtered out and winds up in the tap water again that we make our tea with and drink and cook with. But the Berkey water filter system will take it out. So I just got my Berkey light for the days when, you know, it all falls to pieces and I have to hunker down here with my bag of brown rice. But yeah, the Berkey light, I have to tell you, I put that thing together. The instructions are awful, and I want that known because I'm not the only one who has practically cried trying to put the thing together. But the first, because I didn't prime the filters, it said you don't have to, and I didn't, being lazy and not wishing to tangle more with parts and technology than I needed to. And so the first run took almost 30 hours to filter 2 gallons of water, and I was outraged. And I called the company that sold it to me, and they said, you didn't prime your filters, did you? I said, no. Didn't say that you had to. They said, well, you should have. But now that thing just, it filters 2 gallons of water so fast, and I'm filling up all my other little containers, and I'm making water like there's no tomorrow. It's fun. I would say to everyone, you must have a Berkey. Do you have one?
No, I don't have a Berkey. But you know, I've been drinking water, that treated water, for quite a while, and because I went where I used to live, the water didn't even taste good, and it was kind of weird.
Yeah, well, the Berkey, I bought the arsenic fluoride filters as well.
Uh-huh.
So those were very special. They aren't the usual. There's a 2 carbon, the black filters, and then the other 2. But it's very exciting to have this. I must say, I'm getting ready for the end time.
I've got a friend here that has come into the studio that has been avidly following our conversation here, and he was wondering if he could. His name is Shannon, and he was wondering if maybe he could ask a question or two. Would that be all right with you?
I suppose. I don't know if he's trying to ambush me, but I'm happy to try to answer. Just don't ask me how to put the Berkey light together.
Okay. Okay, Shannon, do you want to go ahead?
Well, I was intrigued. Thanks for your, expansion is definitely the right word for what you're presenting. Thanks for your expansive knowledge. And I just was intrigued by your waiting for maybe a critical mass or something else would describe it better in your words of what would make you think that we are ready for your part two. And I wondered if that had any link to your original comment about the music that we opened with being kind of a low vibration. I was intrigued by your thread there.
Oh, well, again, you know, music is a matter of taste, but it's also a matter of conditioning. And so I have grown out of my fondness for heavy music with a lot of screaming lead guitar and strong percussion. So I don't listen to very much music any longer at all, which is odd, because I used to love it so much. So it seems to me that we have to choose the vibration that we can operate on the most comfortably, and that is created by it's reflected in and to some extent created by our surroundings. So we have to choose our surroundings, and we have to choose what's inside us. As well, you know, our thoughts, for instance. So I'm not a very new age type of person, but I find that I react to my environment very strongly, and I can't tolerate certain things that I could certainly tolerate years ago. And I don't exactly know why. I think that I prefer to be in a different place. I don't want to, how can I put this? I don't want to be torn down by my environment. And loud noise does that for me. arguments. I can't watch television because there are too many dramas with people shouting at one another, and I can't take it. I don't like listening to it. So that's what I mean about the low frequency. We have to ascend out of this three-dimensional lousy reality with all this stress and all this exploitation and suffering. We have to ascend right out of it. We have to airlift ourselves out of it. And the only way we're going to do that is by creating a different frequency habitat, because all that stuff is occurring on low frequency in this three-dimensional world.
And we seem to be bombarded with those low frequencies, are we not?
Yes, because we respond to them. We either react or we affirm them.
Going back to his question on, you know, the second version, one thing that I have, I was observing something today that that had to do with some of the film footage of that had come out of the 9/11 event, and it was a really well done demonstration on some of the filming techniques that were manipulated.
The videos,
mm-hmm.
The planes, are you talking about?
Planes in numerous aspects of positions and placement of people or cameras, and they did a real good demonstration of that, and several times when I had seen some things in footage on my own, I'd noticed that the horizons were, you know, seemed out of kilter. Did you run across this much when you were working with film footage for your video?
Well, I do. You know, I was working on demolition, so we had shots of the planes hitting the towers just to show when we referred to, and the plane hit the tower on the 84th floor or whatever. So that imagery, I remember a couple of times my video editor would reverse the footage, and he would say, well, what's this? And he would see that notorious flash. And he was not very experienced with any of the 9/11 material. And I would say, yeah, that's, you know, that's a big deal, that flash, but that's for the next movie. So we would talk about it a little bit. But I did remark on the way the plane just melted into the building. And I saw the Evan Fairbanks footage on a DVD the other night, that some compilation of a huge amount of news footage and other footage about 9/11. And I had not really had a chance to see the Evan Fairbanks stuff at such length. And I kept playing it over and over and over. It was the plane hitting the South Tower. He had a view that was, I haven't seen before. Some of the media shots were kind of in from the air, and Evan was on the ground. And I'm telling you, there's something really weird about it. That's all I can say now, because I haven't made part two. But the hijackers and planes is something that really defies all reason. That topic. The part one demolitions, at least there is the basis of science, physics, the structural steel and its capabilities and its propensities and so forth. That you can work with as a like non-changing platform. So in Hijackers and Planes, that's the title of my part two, it's all an operation. We don't know who those quote-unquote hijackers were. We don't even know if they were Arabs. They could have been any nationality. They could have never been on the planes. There might never have been any real airliners that ever took off. So it's all up for grabs. And the question is how do you make a movie that convinces people? I mean, the number of questions that one would have to ask in that film would be enormous. And then there is another issue yet that I referred to earlier that Americans aren't ready for. And so I'm waiting for the timing to be a little bit better on that.
Well, I'm wondering a little bit if, I mean, because I'm not even sure. I'm running into a number of people that have studied and are really starting to look at Judy Wood's work.
Mm-hmm.
And she makes some pretty good arguments. I have a lot more to go before I totally understand where she's coming from. But then again, when she uses terminology and then she shows shows good examples of why she comes up with the terminology that she uses that was involved with this, it adds a whole new dimension to that whole those events. And and you might be right about the American public. I'm not sure whether they're going to be able to go there or not. What do you think, Shannon?
I think that I'm a lot of the time thinking that I'm getting some privileged information because I spend a lot of time in books and magazines and have free time to do that and on the internet as well. But maybe I'm representing the public right now that don't know hardly anything about this, because I think, what is it if Sophia, you really were, you know, just spreading your brightest light here tonight, what would it be that you would spark in us that would then cause you to think, okay, soon these people will be ready? You know, you said earlier that you could come at this, you know, from looking at fluoride in the water, looking at vaccinations, the Federal Reserve, religion, perhaps food poisoning, aspartame, and so forth. If all these things converge in some way, is that like the upside down umbrella of what you would like to see as far as the integrated next level of intelligence, or is it not intelligence perhaps that you're waiting for, or what would it? You get the question.
Right, but again, you have to remember, I'm not waiting. I'm not waiting, and I'm not fighting, and I have no real goal. I know I said I'm waiting for the public to be ready for my when I do my part two, but really, that has to do more with timing than waiting, if you know what I mean. I think it's better not to have any expectations about any of this, because it's really one giant wild card. And the variable is you, not anybody else. I don't have to worry about what Joe Schmo is going to do tomorrow and whether he will wake up or not. I have only to worry about myself. How creative am I getting today? That's the question. Not tomorrow and not yesterday. And not even how creative can I be today or will I get today, but am I getting? And that is it. You can do very unusual things in your life right now.
And you have demonstrated that in just in the fact of somebody that comes from nowhere just to make the film that you did. And to me, again, it's still one of the best films depicting what took place on 9/11 in aspects. And do you feel that still?
Do I feel what?
That you really created what you wanted to come forth in with your effort.
Well, I feel that I was an instrument to create something that has had a powerful effect on millions of people, and that kind of shocks me. I was an instrument? Why me? But why not me? And why not you? And why not Shannon? And why shouldn't we just start surprising ourselves immediately?
I agree. When you're talking about expansion, I feel like I'm doing things this now that I wouldn't have dreamed I would have been doing a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. So, and I'm learning more and more each day. And although, you know, I hope that I can, you know, even make, you know, expand more.
Let me tell you something. I was talking to a friend the other night, and he decided he had to lose weight, a lot of weight, like 100 pounds or 50 pounds at least. And he decided he needs to eat right to do that. Well, that's not a bad place to start. And he decided in order to eat right, he probably has to prepare his own food instead of reaching for something convenient, namely fast food or junk. So he had a long discussion with his wife about, it was a 20-minute discussion, he told me, about how to boil spaghetti. And I was amazed that he didn't even know the concept. First you have to take a pot and fill it with water, bring it to a rolling boil. You have to make enough, you know, it has to be a big enough pot that the pasta can move freely, and you have to stir it, and I mean, there are a lot of steps to this that you and I, maybe we've made pasta a million times, we wouldn't even think twice. We would think this was, like, obvious. But I gave him some cooking lessons. He's very excited. He wants me to write a cookbook with him for the American public. I said, oh, my gosh, I have to do that, too? I said, you write the book, but I'll just, he asked me, could you just tell me how to make things? I taught him how to make a salad the other night. Can you believe this? I said, first you put mixed greens. If you just put one lettuce, that's fine. But you can put three kinds, and you can even buy them already mixed. You put that at the bottom of the bowl. Then add a layer of shredded something like cabbage or grated zucchini or grated carrots. Then add heavy or soft, chunky vegetables like tomato, cucumber, mushroom. Then I taught him the most wonderful salad dressing that someone taught me years ago, and I've never changed from that. And I'm not even going to tell anyone. It's because I don't want to. I don't wanna impress or impose my way of doing things on everybody. But so he went to the supermarket and he bought all this at 10 o'clock at night, and he made his first salad. And he was very pleased. So the next day I taught him how to cook winter greens, because we're coming into winter, and there's chard and kale and all this wonderful stuff. Collard greens, you can even buy those chopped up. And I was telling him, first you take a skillet, and you put a little olive oil in it and some chopped garlic. And he said, wait, wait, wait. He said, what's a skillet, and where do you buy one? But, okay, so what's the point of this? Not that he's stupid. The point is, he is so interested, and he's doing it. He's going to buy a skillet the next time I talk to him. I bet you anything. And he will end up, I'm guaranteeing in 6 months, being a very active and obsessed cook. He's going to be experimenting, making all kinds of foods. He's going to have his hand on how to season, all the stuff that it takes so many people a lifetime to perfect. I can see it in this guy.
So instead of just making a salad, he's building a salad.
Well, yeah, that's how I do it. And I've just taught people how to cook over the years, particularly men, because they have relied on women to do it for them, or they've gone out and bought the food. But that's not to say they're helpless or they're ignorant. I think that if this particular person I'm talking about is going to change his life and the lives of many, many, many people. He told me he has a very large family, and none of the teenagers or young adults in it know how to cook. They don't even know how to boil pasta. And if he can teach all of them, well then, we're back to, we don't have to the general foods isn't feeding us. That's what we want. We want to take it away from general foods. We don't want to be eating Ritz crackers with squeezable Velveeta.
Well, pasta.
What are you mumbling about?
to lose weight, pasta? It sounds like your salad idea is way more right on for him.
Well, he was doing pasta. That was his thing. But yes, you know, it's really about how much refined food you eat, and pasta is refined, but there's whole wheat and all other kinds of pasta too, and high water volume foods, high roughage and unrefined, and you're going to lose weight. There's no question about it.
So, Sophia, you had Kay Griggs on and did an interview. What do you feel like you walked away with from learning in that particular interview? Do you have anything
that struck you? Well, that was a while back, and I know Kay pretty well. I've had many, many phone conversations with her, but I had never done a formal interview with her myself. So I had her on the show, and she is a very, very wonderful woman. Her courage, her ability to see into this, and the enormous terrain that she has familiarity with, names, dates, places. She's extremely rare. And so what did I walk away with? I mean, if I listened to the interview again, I could tell you, oh, well, such and such I wasn't exactly aware of. But I thought it was important how she framed the shaping, the cultivation of men in power. And we can see this in Obama. Obama is, I was watching his campaign a little bit, just catching snippets of it, because I wasn't actively interested. But it hit me one day. He's what they call a rising star. He was selected at a young age. I think that's why he has such a dubious early childhood. We don't know where he really lived. A lot of this is made up. But he was selected to become a world leader, one of the NWO figures, at a very young age. And then he went to, I think, this Occidental College, which is one of the rising star colleges. And I'm using rising star in the terminology that Kay Griggs defines it. Usually it's prominent families, but sometimes it's sons from backgrounds of no father or poor father or absent father, which is Obama.
And actually, when he was introduced at the Democratic convention, when he was running for senator, they introduced him as a rising star.
Yes, they're throwing those words right out there. Absolutely. And his star quality and all that. But rising star is what the New World Order military, they actually select people and call them rising stars. There are members of Delta Force and the SEALs, Marines, who are rising stars. And they are people who have a profile that makes them extremely malleable and easy to shape as assassins, as super destroyers without real conscience or emotion. And Obama is one of the leader class rising stars, as was apparently Kissinger, Pol Pot, Hitler was one, George Bush Jr., George Bush Sr., these were all rising stars. I have to say, this is the opinion of Kay Griggs. I've learned from her, but it all makes sense.
So what she's talking about is what she hears from the society that she associates with, or...
Well, remember, she was the wife of a rising star. She was the wife of Colonel George Raymond Griggs. He was Chief of Staff of the Marine Corps, Atlantic. There are two sides of it. And then also he was head of psychological operations at NATO. And he was very powerful, very influential, and very influenced. I mean, it's, you are never influential without also being influenced. And the influence starts at a very young age, and it is systematic, and it is part of the whole Tavistock, you know, mind control platform that issued out of Nazi Germany, that was taught to the Nazis by the international globalists, who are, many of whom are Zionists, the top ruling families, the elite. They created all of this stuff. I mean, they've created all the sides of everything.
So, because you had a Mr. Patton on who got into this mind control thing.
Oh, Ron Patton?
Mm-hmm.
I think Ron was talking about a different level of it.
Really?
I don't think Ron is as versed in the political mind control as he is in the... He has sheltered some of the escapees from... you know, the sex slave level of mind control. So he knows a lot about that, and I don't know that his expertise is on the level of a Kay Griggs, who actually was married to one, and who, that guy, George Griggs was an alcoholic, and evidently when he drank too much, he would... The mind control effect would start to wear off, and he would become himself, and he would confess to Kay about all of the stuff that was being done at the very high levels of military, and she would listen. And being a history buff and a curious person with a very active mind, and also living among other people of George Griggs's stature in the military, she knew wives of other generals and so forth, she started to really piece things together. So her presentation of the sort of black backstage of the U.S. government and military and special operations, which isn't limited to the United States, it's apparently practiced internationally, that's, to me, something that's very formidable.
Now, I've listened to a number of her interviews, and one of the things that kind of struck me was how, it's like you were saying, you know, it didn't necessarily mean rising star, but how the aspect that these people are groomed from a very young age, and then they do something to them how do I describe it? It's kind of like they shock them or create a situation where that breaks them down and then makes them more malleable. Does that sound ring true with what she was getting into with these cadets or whatever that go to these private schools for military? Do you remember her talking about that
at
all?
Yes. I don't know if you're referring to the systematic ways in which they're broken down and sort of shaped, psychologically traumatized. If you're asking me to explain that, or... What do you want me to...
Okay, well, I guess that was what really struck me, and I don't know if that made as much impression on you as it did me, but it seemed like some of those men never recovered from it.
No, they break souls. And when I mentioned very early in this interview about the desire to appropriate human free will, another thing that they want to destroy and appropriate and render completely useless to us is our soul. And soul is, of course, an open term. What is the soul? But the spirit, the beingness in the human is what they destroy by their control methods. And they work an individual into a state of complete submission, a state of being completely dominated, such that that person is pretty much theirs for the rest of his life. And in some cases, you know, as people distance themselves, if they move away from this milieu, they, I suppose, start to recover who they are, but they end up being extremely confused for decades, I can imagine. Mm-hmm. And as when I interviewed Alfred Weber, that was another very gratifying interview because he said something I never expected him to say. I didn't really know him that well, and I was so happy to hear this. He said that the New World Order targets the mind. Its mind control efforts target largely the brain. They're brain-oriented. And where it misses reaching us and having an effect is on our soul, spirit, higher self. So I think that if they can get an individual in their control, they can more easily destroy the soul, spirit, higher self. But the population at large, they're mainly targeting our brains, and they're not as easily able to reach us on the level of the higher self. That's still ours to hold on to. But we have to light a fire in that higher self and say, okay, this part of me is me, it's mine, I'm not going to let them have it.
Well, Sophia, it's getting to the point of the evening that we need to kind of bring a close to it. And I'm just wondering if you had any closing thoughts, or I know we went all over the map on a lot of things, but I hope that, you know, the audience was given a good idea of the scope and expansion of your experience. And do you have anything more to say?
Well, yes, I can. I want to thank you for having me on again. I want to thank Shannon for listening and asking his questions and caring as much as he does. And I just want to say to everybody that I'm just learning. I don't really know very much at all, but the world of expansion is right out there. That's why I called my show Expansion, and it's only by expanding that we're going to get beyond this.
Well, again, I want to thank you, and I will continue to listen and follow, and I've got some extra programs to go back to catch up on some of the areas, because I really do like your perspective. You have to me, you don't just have a guest on just to have a guest. I get the feeling that you really do have a purpose in why you bring on those guests.
Well, I'm glad you think so. I mean, I can't see purpose as clearly as maybe an outsider can. I'm really just stumbling along as much as anyone, and I'm glad it seems coherent to so many people, but I can't claim credit for that.
Well, maybe I read something into it then, but you really do. So the questions you ask come from avenues that I really feel that, you know, comes from your heart and thought.
Yeah, well, that much I guess I should acknowledge, that on some level I'm curious. This is real. My curiosity is not fake.
Well, again, I want to thank you, and good night, Sophia.
Good night to you, and thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay.
This is KHN Radio, KHN LPFM 106.9 Salida.